So tonight I want to talk about the shorter discourse on the lion's roar. This is an interesting sutta for me for several reasons. One of them is that it sort of puts the Buddha into context of his time. And he was part of a huge number of different teachings and different sects of teaching and teachers that were all around in North India at his time, you know, 2600 years ago. It was North India was very vibrant in this area. And there were lots of different teachings, lots of different teachers. And so this sutta sort of puts him into context, and then also, of course, says this is why he differentiates himself. At the end of the sutta, he actually differentiates himself from all the other teachings, sort of saying this is what makes what I do different or special. And also, I'll start just by reading the first couple of verses of the sutta here. Bhikkhus, only here is there a recluse, only here a second recluse, only here a third recluse, only here a fourth recluse. The doctrines of others are devoid of recluses. That is how you should rightly roar your lion's roar. So he's saying right off, to roar your lion's roar, like a lion is like this powerful animal, right? And to roar like a lion is to declare, in a sense, in this case, this is the teaching that actually works. Not all those other teachings. And then it goes on and says, it is possible, bhikkhus, that wanderers of other sects will say, might ask, but on the strength of what argument or with the support of what authority do the venerable ones say this? Wanderers of other sects who ask thus may be answered in this way. Friends, four things have been declared to us by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. On seeing this in ourselves, we say thus. Only here there is a recluse. Only here a second recluse. Only here a third recluse. Only here a fourth recluse. The doctrines of others are devoid of recluses. What are the four? We have confidence in the teacher. We have confidence in the Dhamma. We have fulfilled the precepts. And our companions in the Dhamma are dear and agreeable to us, whether they are laymen or those gone forth. These are the four things declared to us by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, on seeing which in ourselves we say as we do. So this is an interesting place to start, because what he's saying basically is that what differentiates these recluses, these bhikkhus, is that they lead a virtuous life and they follow the precepts and they take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. This is where, once again, where the Buddha always wants to start. He wants to start by saying, lead a virtuous life and take refuge. Those are the first prerequisites to understanding his teaching. Excuse me. But then, of course, in the next verse, he says, and of course, those bhikkhus on those other sects are going to say, yeah, but our teacher does, we have the same. We take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and in our own way, we follow the precepts, our own version of the precepts. So how come are you any different from us? And the Buddha acknowledges, yeah, that's true. There are groups that are similar in that way to what I do. And then in the next few verses, which I'm not going to read, it gets quite lengthy. The Buddha goes on through a list of other things that are important. Having only one goal. Being free from lust, being free from hate, being free from delusion, being free from clinging, as before. And that, even then, after he goes through that list and says, see, here's all these other things. You know, not being caught by the three poisons, which is really what he's describing here. These other sects are equal in regard to understanding of these things as well. He has to admit that. But then we get to verse 9. Actually, verses 8 and 9. And he's saying, basically, well, let's read verse 9. He says, Bhikkhus, there are these four kinds of clinging. What four? Clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. So now he's getting sort of down into the nitty-gritty. He's saying, here's the real issue. You know, the whole clinging is always, you know, remember, clinging is the problem as he lays it out in the second noble truth. You know, in the first noble truth, he describes suffering, you know, the difficulties of life. And in the second noble truth, he says, and here's why things are so difficult. It's because we cling. But then, now at this point, he's going, but look at these actual reasons why we cling. What is it that we actually cling to that creates all our suffering? And then he goes through this list of four things: clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. So these are the four ways we cling. And then, so I want to spend a fair amount of time now actually looking at what these are, as the Buddha does in the sutta. So first of all, clinging to sense pleasures through objects. We all want to be happy, without exception. I've never met anybody who didn't say to me, gee, I would like to be happy. And the problem is, at this level, we think somehow that the next thing, the next desire we satisfy, you know, it's hot, I want ice cream. It's whatever it is, you know, we always, then that's how our mind works. It's like, oh, I want this, I want this, I want this. And we somehow think, if I could just satisfy that, then I'll be happy. And we cling continually to this idea that somehow satisfying our sense desires is the answer to happiness. Oh, and this isn't surprising. Our whole culture talks about this, you know. And we somehow think, you know, they haven't worked yet, but the next hit, you know, the next thing, sensory pleasure that we have, that's the one that's really gonna work. You know, if you've ever seen a dog walking along and sniffing things, it's like, oh, now the next thing I smell, that's gonna be the real good one. And it just, he goes from, or she goes from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, and never is quite satisfied because there's always more things to smell. It's always something really good, just, you know, 20 paces further on, if I just trot along a bit. Never satisfied. But we somehow think, if I could only find the right combination of pleasurable things, then I'll be happy. If I can just somehow put it all together. And there are probably moments in everybody's life where we get really close to that. We have moments, even brief periods of time, where everything is just like wonderful. But then, because everything's impermanent and everything's changing all the time, things shift, and now we're not happy again. It's just, that's the nature of human existence, that we can never satisfy those cravings, because we always get new ones. Just always more, always more, always more. There's a great story. This is in Joseph Goldstein's book, The Experience of Insight. And the first time I read this story, I laughed out loud for quite a while. It's quite a wonderful little story. There's a story about Mullah Nasruddin, a famous Sufi teaching figure. One day he went to the market and saw a big bushel of hot chili peppers on sale. He bought them, returned home, and began to eat. A little while later, his disciples came and saw the mullah with tears streaming down his face, his mouth and tongue burning. "Mullah, mullah, why do you go on eating them?" As he reached for another, Nasruddin replied, "I keep waiting for a sweet one." And that's what we do. We think, oh, the next one, that's going to be the sweet one. Even though, you know, our mouth is burning and our eyes are streaming sometimes from the last one still. We get caught in that idea that somehow or other is the sweet one, the one that's really going to work, is going to be there somehow. So that's the first of the things we cling to. And it's the most obvious. So it isn't like I'm not saying anything you don't know. But the Buddha always mentions this first when he's talking about these things, because it's the thing that everybody immediately understands, because we all know this. Then the next thing we cling to are views and opinions. This is a bit trickier, because intellectually we think somehow we've got things figured out. We know what's right. We know the best way to do things, whether it's as simple as, like, I know the best way to make pickles, which I've been doing the last few days, to, you know, I know the answer to all of the world's problems and all everything in between. And we have sometimes very fixed views and opinions on how things should be. First of all, watch yourself. If you, in your mind, you hear yourself saying, that's the way things should be, or that's the way things always are, or that's the way, you know, my father and mother did it, or whatever, however you phrase that. That's the, you know, the red light is on the dashboard going, you know, maybe this is just a view or an opinion. Maybe this is just an idea of what I think is right based on how I was brought up, what culture I lived in, what religion I was brought up in, what not religion I was brought up in, what baseball team I like. I mean, it could be anything. It could be anything. Because our mind is full of these views and opinions. Most of our arguments in the world are arguments about views. You know, this teaching is the right teaching because God gave us this book. This is correct. Everything else is wrong. Boom. Now we got a war. Just like that. And that's, if you look at the history of the world and you look at the history of wars and all the things that are going on right now in our country, for that matter, you know, there's these views and opinions. You know, one side says you have to wear a mask no matter what. And that's my view too. I agree with that view, right? But there are, and I suspect that there might even be some legitimacy to some people who think, no, that's not necessarily all the time. You know, when I'm, you know, blah, 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 whatever. And then there's, you know, people with a view like this is a plot to force the government to its knees and ruin the economy, and then Donald Trump is going to lose the election. That's a view. that people hold very strongly. And as long as we don't see that that's just a view, that's one way to look at things, even though it seems, yeah, I've got it right. As long as we cling to that view, whatever it is, about whatever topic it is, we're going to get into problems with other people and create suffering. We're going to get into arguments and discussions. And I'm not saying you shouldn't say what you think. But this should always be in that statement of you're saying what you think or how you feel about something. There should be a room for a but. Yeah, but maybe I'm open to other hearing other opinions. I'm not saying I'm right and you're wrong, my way or the highway, which is where we often end up in all kinds of discussions. And so these views and opinions, some of which are so deeply embedded, are views on what sex we are. Pretty deeply embedded, but there's always this sort of little this, little of that in all people's sexuality that we don't even talk about. You know, it's like, no, this is what I am. Or our sexuality, or our racial identity, or you know, it's endless, these views and opinions. And this is what causes a lot of problems in the world, a lot of suffering in the world, both for ourselves and for others, being caught in believing in these views and opinions. They act sort of like filters on reality. I think that's a really good description of views and opinions. There are filters on reality. There's what, how things are, and then we see, we it's like looking at things through rose-colored glasses or whatever colored glasses. You know, we don't actually see things as they are. We see them filtered through our set of views and opinions of how things should be. There's a, I'll finish this section with it. This is the third Zen patriarch, who is famous for wise sayings, this third Zen patriarch. And this is actually one of my absolute favorites. Do not seek the truth. Pretty radical thing for a Buddhist teacher to say, right? Do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. See, that's what we have to do. Once we stop cherishing opinions, then what is will become clear. Do not seek the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. So that's the second way we cling. Then the third one on the list is rites and rituals. And we want to think about this, first of all, in the context of the Buddha's time. I mean, the Buddha was living in North India at a time where the predominant culture was the what's called the Brahmanic culture. The Brahmins, the priests, were the ones who decided what was right and what was wrong. They were the ones in charge, and they had, for every possible situation, rites and rituals that were ways of perpetuating the gods, or asking the gods for something, or how to do things right. This is the way things should be done. That, you know, if you want to, you know, get another cow, here's a ritual you want to do to make sure you get a good cow, and so on and so on and so on. And it was like, it was the whole of life was ritualized in this way. And of course, only the Brahmins could perform these rituals, which is how they controlled everything. They controlled everything, all of life, by saying only we can perform these rituals. And we have these books, the Vedas, that have in them the description of all these thousands of different rituals. And only we can read them, and only we can perform these rituals. And basically, if you were born into a Brahmin family, if you were born a male, pardon me, if you were born a male in a Brahmin family, then you would be trained from birth to perform these rituals. And it's like that was your duty. That was your job in the world, was to be the one who could do these things. And the Buddha basically said, "Yeah, not true." And which really upset the Brahmins, by the way. I mean, there were people who tried to kill him because of this. They didn't succeed, luckily. But he was like this radical person who said, no, if you want to connect to the divine, you have to do it yourself. You can't do it through someone else performing the correct ritual. It's something that has to be individual. You know, there he is dying, and the very last teaching he gives is, be a light unto yourselves. Don't depend on anyone else. You're the one who has to do this yourself. Be a light unto yourself. So it was like, in his culture, this was a big issue, which is why he separates this out from normal, because this is really just a subset of views and opinions in some way, right? So what's the relevance of this to us in our culture? Well, our culture too has a lot of ritual, sometimes quite disguised, but certainly still spiritual, quote, rituals. This is especially true in the, quote, spiritual culture that exists so strongly here in Boulder, but also exists so strongly in general in that certain segment of the population, right? Where people, once again, you know, attach to a certain form or certain way of doing things, and they say, this is the right way. If you want to be a Buddhist, you have to wear black, and you have to do this, and you have to do that. And there's a certain thing or less set of things that make you a good Buddhist, right? Or a good Christian, or a good whatever. And these things just get in the way, you know. And in this spiritual culture, in a sense, there are also some very, very, from my point of view, harmful spiritual ideas that are propagated and cause untold grief. The biggest one of these, and this, I want to speak for this a little bit because it's so important, I think, is this whole part of this, quote, spiritual culture that has this belief that basically says you're responsible for everything that happens to you. If you get sick, it's because you're responsible for it. It's something you did in a past life, or something you did in this life, or you're not living the right way, or you're not following the rules the right way, whatever. You got sick, it's your fault. You lost your job, it's your fault. You got in a car accident, it's your fault. Whatever happens, it's your fault. This is incredibly harmful way of thinking, because it puts people in a position where they feel guilty. Oh, it's all my fault. And this causes people to untold suffering for people. And the truth of the matter is, life is pretty random. It's like stuff just happens. Things happen, and you know, all of a sudden now you just got run over by a car, or got sick, or lost your job, or, you know, who knows? You know, all these things, everything is pretty much just random stuff happens. And we're not responsible at all, most of the time, for that stuff itself. Sometimes, you know, we do something really stupid and sure enough, there's a result. But in general, what we're responsible for, and this is why I think more than any other reason I really was attracted to the Buddha's teachings, is this stuff just happens. All we're responsible for, all we can possibly do for that matter, is learn to skillfully react to what arises. I got sick, now I can either be skillful or I can sit, oh, woe is me, I'm so poor, it's not fair, blah, blah, blah. Or I can accept that this is what's going on in my life right now and I have to deal with it. It's no one's fault, it's just stuff's happened, now I have to deal with it. It's a different way of looking at things that the, quote, spiritual culture doesn't like. Because the reason people like to say that, and I think in a way, is it's like, oh, now I don't have to do anything to help them because it's their fault anyway. Or, you know, my life is great, which means I must be doing everything right, you know, until something goes wrong. And it's a perverse way of thinking. That is our culture's equivalent of the rites and rituals of the Brahmins back 2,500 years ago, as far as I'm concerned. So that's the rites and rituals thing. And so for each of these three, as the Buddha, as you go through the sutta, you know, the Buddha's talking about, you know, clinging to sense pleasures, clinging to views and opinions, clinging to rites and rituals. And at each point, the people who are listening to the discourse basically say, yes, but sure. So our teachings say exactly the same thing. You know, maybe different words, but it's like, this is like you haven't said anything we don't know already that differentiates your teachings from other teachings that are prevalent in the world today. And remember, this all started with the Buddha saying, but we're different. Here's why. And so then he finally comes to the last of these four. And this is where things start to get different. And this is once again from the experience of insight. And this is this sense of a separate self. This is like where the Buddha's teachings are so strongly different from anything else. The fourth of these bonds, and the most subtle, the most deeply conditioned, is our attachment to the belief that in self, in I, in me, in mine, the belief that there is some permanent entity in the mind body which is experiencing all of this. Because of this belief, and to satisfy the I, the self, we get involved in all kinds of unwholesome actions, all kinds of greed and hatred, all kinds of delusion, for the gratification of the self, which isn't even there. I love that part. Our attachment to the concept of self is so great that everything we do revolves about it, tying the bonds even tighter to this mass of pain. Pretty strong words. So here's the interesting thing about this concept of self. And that's that the Buddha said in another place, I won't read the actual place in the sutta, but when he's talking about his enlightenment experience, he said, and the last thing I had to let go of was a subtle sense of a separate self. So this isn't like, you know, well, we'll take care of this one and move on, you know. This is the one that's most deeply embedded, because it's so, it's like, well, of course I'm me, this is my body and my mind and my stuff and my job and my this and my that and my family and my kids, and we have all these ways of it's that makes it so clear somehow that yeah, I'm separate from everyone else. There's a separate me here that somehow can observe and experience all this stuff that's arising. And that basically what the Buddha says, and he says it very clearly and very distinctly and spends a lot of time talking about this, is nope, not true. That this idea of a separate self is just something that we cling to. And we cling to it because if we let it go, what are we left with? It's kind of, it's a really sort of scary thought, to be honest with you. What's left for me if I don't if I don't have this sense of self, what's left? And so just the fear of that is often what gets in the way more than anything else. It's like, oh my God, I can't possibly deal with that. There's another thing I want to read by Joseph. I'll mark my place in this book here first. This is from his book, Mindfulness, where he's talking about this same topic in a way. And this is, he's talking about this idea of a separate self and how insidious it is, I suppose would be a good word. And he calls this the desire to be. It is called craving for becoming, for renewed existence. This is a very basic urge or desire to be. It is a desire for continuing existence, particularly in pleasant realms. We may or may not believe in rebirth and different planes of existence, although they are mentioned often in the Buddhist teachings, but we don't have to believe in them in order to experience this powerful craving for becoming. We see it in the planning mind. In the act of imagining ourselves in some future situation. We might be planning for something at work or perhaps for our next vacation. It all starts with just a thought. And then weeks or months or even years later, the whole chain of thoughts and actions has materialized in our lives. Notice how often we get lost in fantasies of future self. I'll do this, I'll go there. Losing ourselves in these projects is a manifestation of craving for becoming. So this always looking into the future and figuring out what comes next is a way of continually creating this sense of a separate self, because I'm the one who's going to do that in the future. And I keep, so it keeps my sense of separate self strong. Now, I'm not saying, I want to be very clear here, that we don't have to at times in our lives plan for things. What am I going to make for dinner? Well, I can't just sort of sit back and magically dinner is going to appear. I have to plan and, go to the store if I need something from the store and look and see what I need and go pick stuff from the garden, whatever it is I'm doing. So you have to plan, but it's when we cling to those plans, when we think this is how it's going to be, this is who I'm going to be in the future. Because often those plans just don't happen at all. This is actually a retreat that happened, a thing that happens on long retreats, where it's getting close to the end of the retreat, and you start thinking, you know, a couple of days before the end, or sometimes more even, what you're going to do when you get out of retreat. Oh, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and isn't this going to be great? And then the retreat is over, and you're on your way home or on your way to wherever you're going next. And if you actually counted how often what you were thinking about on retreat was going to happen and what actually happened, it would be like 5%. Really. I mean, it's like, it's incredible how little of those things we think we're going to do actually happen for any number of reasons. So it's tricky, because we have to function in the world, in this world of relative reality. We have to make plans to sort of function in the world. When am I going to go shopping? You know, when am I going to do this? We have to sort of, you know, have a little book and I write things down. You know, I'm going to go see this client on this day and this time, and I have to make sure I take these tools, and, you know, you have to plan. But it's because we believe those plans are actually going to happen. That's where we get into trouble. Because sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And we always are creating the sense of, this is me projected into the future. So it's a really strong way to create this sense of a separate self. I want to read. So this is from a different sutta. This is called a sutta that's called A Single Excellent Night. And it talks very precisely about what I've been talking about here in the Buddha's language. And he's talking about what it's like to have a single excellent night. Right? Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes. For the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let him see each presently arisen state. Let him know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today, the effort must be made. Tomorrow, death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. No one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage, has said, who has had a single excellent night. I love that line, death may come, who knows? I had a teacher, Swami Vishnudevananda, who, this was a big theme of his in his teaching. And he would often, you know, there'd be a bunch of us all together and he'd ask this question. And he said, you know, those of you who know the answer, don't say anything out loud. And his question was always the same. He said, what's the difference between yesterday and today? You know, and people would answer things like, well, you know, it was raining yesterday, it's sunny today. You know, yesterday was Wednesday, today is Thursday. I mean, all kinds of different answers. And then his answer was always the same. He says, no, no, no. The difference between yesterday and today is the day you're one day closer to death. And we'd all groan, like, oh, Swamiji, you're so depressing. But what he was doing was saying, face this truth. You know, that's the absolute truth of how things are. And let that thought spur you to take your practice more seriously. You can't bargain with mortality, as the sutta says there. It's like every day, we're one day closer to the day we're going to die. Who knows when that is? Might be tomorrow, could be 20 years from now, who knows? But that's part of the impetus to practice, is to understand that this self I cling to will be gone just like that. It's going to disappear. Guaranteed. You know, life is a disease with 100% mortality rate, as someone once said. Which is true. And we have to take that in. Yeah? And then, and this is what's interesting. This is where the Buddha says, this understanding that the self is non-existent. In the world of absolute reality, there is no separate self. This is what differentiates the Buddha's teachings from all other teachings. This is the one that stands out. No matter what, this is what made the Buddha's teachings unique. This is why it was the last thing that he had to deal with before he became enlightened. Because this was the deepest, the hardest, most subtle thing. Which I, to be honest with you, I can only pretend to understand. Up to a certain point, I can sort of, I get this, and I've had some experiences around it. But, you know, this is like subtle stuff and difficult to grasp and difficult to face, even. Which is why it's so difficult to grasp, is we don't want to think about it. But it's like this is the place where the Buddhist teachings stand out as different from any of the other traditions. That this sense of there is no sense of a separate self. There's no soul. There's no being of light. None of those things exist. They don't. And then at the end of the sutta, after he's gone through and explained all this, then the Buddha has two more things, interesting things to say. He's finished talking about all these forms of clinging. He says, now these four kinds of clinging have what as their source? What as their origin? From what are they born and produced? These four kinds of clinging have craving as their source, craving as their origin. They are born and produced from craving. Craving has what as its source? Craving has feeling as its source. Feeling has what as its source? Feeling has contact as its source. Contact has what as its source? Contact has the sixfold base as its source. Also, contact is any sense experience at any of the six sense doors. And the sixfold base is those six sense doors. So what he's saying here is the reason we cling is that we keep experiencing contact with the world. Oh, that seems like a problem somehow. And this is also really important. Basically, we can't avoid contact. We can't avoid having sense experiences. You know, you see, meditations, quote, spiritual meditation people who, you know, put, you know, on earmuffs and a blindfold and plug up their nose, and, you know, it's like they go to extremes, they shut off all their senses so that they can, quote, meditate. And what the Buddha is saying here is this is just what happens. We're going to be constantly having contact happen. We're constantly going to have things arising at the six senses. So what the whole of the practice isn't about avoiding contact, isn't about avoiding sensory experience, isn't about avoiding having thoughts. It's not about not thinking. It's all of his teachings, what they're really about is looking at how we can live wisely so that we don't get caught by those experiences, that we see them as for what they are. They're just experiences flowing by, this constant stream. You know, when you really look at what's going on at the level of mind, all that's going on ever is one experience, one thought, another sense experience, this, there's that. There's just this stuff happening. Constant flow, never stops. But we get caught up in them and we start clinging to them in a variety of ways, as he's described. And we have to abandon, there's that word again. We have to abandon our ignorance, abandon our clinging. And then, I just lost my page, I have to find the page again. Then he says, and this is the conclusion to the sutta. Bhikkhus, when ignorance is abandoned and true knowledge has arisen in a bhikkhu, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, he no longer clings to sensual pleasures. He no longer clings to views, no longer clings to rules and observances, no longer clings to a doctrine of self. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What has to be done has been done. There's no more coming to any state of being. This is pretty standard language at the end of a lot of suttas, where the Buddha is basically saying, remember, this is basically the second and third noble truths. What causes suffering is clinging. How to stop that suffering is to stop clinging. That's the third noble truth. And when you stop clinging, then you stop clinging to these four areas that we constantly are clinging to. Then you're no longer agitated. It's a great expression, like, no longer agitated, no longer caught by what's arising. And he personally attains nibbana. So that's the end of the sutta. Actually, one other thing I want to read. Of course, I have to go to contemporary poetry to talk about this as well. This is once again from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In, where I often read something. This poem is called Staring at the Bones. Sooner or later, life in its variety and wisdom chews the meat from the bones of my illusions. It sucks the marrow from inside and throws the dry bone to bleach in a pile. Expectations are treated with equal disdain. Stripped of their finery, they are revealed as nothing more than future plans, easy ways to stay safe, roadmaps drawn by a blind cartographer. I love that line. Roadmaps drawn by a blind cartographer trying to imagine distant destinations. This is the present moment's boot camp. Life's lack of rules will be obeyed, or I'll spend my time peeling potatoes in the past. I can choose to leave behind the skeletons of what I thought I knew and raise the flag of truth on the front porch. I can take a single step and wait for the next one to be revealed. I can only know where I am in this moment. Anything else is a desperate attempt to clothe the bones and set them walking. That's a great Dharma poem as far as I'm concerned. And it's really very much directed to what the Buddha is talking about in this sutta. So that's all I really have to say. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.